This is Karen Edwards, and I'll be talking about depression, primarily how I have experienced it, because first and foremost, I have no qualifications in terms of education. I've taken very few psychology classes in college, and that was not my major, so I'm not a psychologist. I don't have a lot of clinical knowledge about depression, but I have been depressed three times in my life, fairly severely, depressions that lasted for 4 months. I think it's pretty typical of people who have been depressed not to talk about it easily. They try to avoid remembering it because their memories are very painful. And so I'm very grateful for doing this. Over the course of the years, I have thought about my depressions, and I have done some classes, and I have done some study on them, but kind of doing this has tied together a lot of things for me. And I was able to sit down and really put all three depressions together and kind of look at the things that were similar, the things that were different, the ways they were treated. And I think it's been very valuable for me, so I'm really grateful for this opportunity. When I look back on being depressed, the overwhelming feeling is that I would almost do anything to avoid being depressed again. The memory and the feeling associated with that is so painful. But I think it's really important to look back and to remember and to realize the things that were necessary in the healing to avoid it in the future. So I'll briefly talk about depression in general, some of the information that I've gleaned over the years and that I have learned through reading a few books, its symptoms, the possible causes of depression, the types of treatment that are available, and then I will share what I can of my personal experience. And with that outline in particular, a class that helped me the third time I was severely depressed, kind of outlined that class, what we did within that class, and the things that I found particularly helpful in that situation. And finally, at the end, I might just wing it a bit and kind of just some thoughts and some random ideas of that I've kind of tied together over my life in the course of the reading and studies that I've done as to why or maybe possible reasons depression is so prevalent, especially in our society, especially among women, and maybe some things as a community of faith and Christians that we can think about or educate ourselves toward in bringing about change within our society or within ourselves so that this becomes less of a problem. And if we have time for questions then, or any time during, any questions, please. First of all, one of the definitions I really like, and I got this out of Unfinished Business by Maggie Scarf, one of the books in our library, which I would really recommend to anybody interested in depression or reading about depression. A statement from this book is, depression means not trusting in any of the good things. I'll say that again. Depression means not trusting in any of the good things. And I think that is as concise a statement as you can make about what it's like to be depressed. There are two basic types of depression. First is bipolar disorder or manic depression, and Sarah Boggison's tape in the library is just excellent about this, so I won't talk very much about chemical depression. The chemical imbalance in the body stores too much sodium and lithium, or different drugs are used to treat people with this kind of depression, to reduce the sodium in the body and so on, but listen to Sarah's tape. It's very, very good. The kind of depression that I suffered from, and I think a lot of people, is a unipolar depression. The mood plunges. Bipolar is manic depression. Your mood can go real high and go real low. Unipolar depression, your mood plunges and it stays down. And it's not necessarily a chemical cause. And I say that because for myself, I've never had any chemical treatment other than a few antidepressants, and I've recovered. So somehow it's situational, somehow it's personal. There is something within the body that is not allowing the body to process stress, process the things that are affecting it, and your mood plunges, it stays down there, and you can't come out. It can be because of situation, because of loss, death. It could be because of stress or repressed angers, repressed fears, things from the childhood. So those are some of the things I want to talk about. A good quote from Unfinished Business is that not everyone who becomes stressed and discouraged by difficulties encountered in their lives becomes clinically depressed. Some people don't have what Dr. Peter Wybrow, he's a psychiatrist at Dartmouth Medical School, has spoken of as a kind of biological permission to become depressed. And what I kind of see is a tube with valves at each end, and your mood is in between, is in that tube, in between these two valves. And someone who becomes depressed, somehow those valves are not functioning, and the mood either plummets or goes too high. The valves are not closing to contain that mood within that defined sphere. So somehow there's a chemical or a biological permission within some people that will not allow those valves to close to contain the mood within limits that are acceptable, within limits that the person can handle. I gave you a handout some on the symptoms of depression, just so we don't have to go over them all. The physical symptoms.
I have a question about the valve.
Sure.
Now, is this a physical valve tube that's located somewhere in our...
No, this is
an abstract?
Yeah, that's just a kind of abstract concept that I've kind of developed on my own. And, yeah, no, there's no actual physical thing. The physical things that actually happen within depressed people are either the buildup, like of sodium salts in the body, the absence of, I can't pronounce the words, but the serotonin and this and another chemical within the nerve synapses that are replaced often by antidepressants, those kinds of chemical things, or somehow just a psychological or biological inability to cope with the mood changes, to contain the mood changes. And that tube idea is just a real abstract thing, a way I kind of think about it, because I can't think in terms of nerves and the way my body functions. Okay, the physical characteristics of depression, the emotional characteristics of depression are on your handouts. You can just kind of look over those. I won't talk about them a lot at this time. The causes of depression, I've kind of reduced in my own mind to four broad areas. Major life changes or loss, and loss is a big word when it comes to depression. That characterizes a lot of the causes of depression. Also gradual changes, gradual life changes that are not being coped with. The individual cannot cope with them. Inward stress, an inward stress of either not being able to deal with something that's happening in the childhood, that has happened in the childhood, or something that's happened in interpersonal relationships around us. So inward stress, not being able to cope with that, and outward stress, our lifestyle, our job, the way we are living, the life situation. So I'd like to talk about those four. Major life changes, first of all. As I said, a word that characterizes those major life changes can be loss, or it's a loss of something actual, or something that's just viewed by the person that is easily depressed as a loss. Maybe another person would not view this particular thing as a loss, but the person who's easily prone to distress will view things as losses. So first of all, of course, death or divorce, the loss of a person. One of the statements that I liked about this was, our loving relationships aid us from infancy onward in orienting to the world. And sometimes these relationships, or one such relationship, seems to constitute everything in a particular person's world. That love bond is then perceived as something necessary for survival. And its loss, or its threatened loss, is equated to the loss of everything, including any reason for further existence. So loss of person through death, through divorce. Another loss is moving to another location, a loss of place, a loss of security and familiarity. Some people cannot cope with this. Financial reversal, a loss of security. You can't make the living you were used to making. Your lifestyle may have to change. So financial reversals can cause depression. accidents can also cause depression, either a physical accident or an act of God kind of accident. There's a loss then of your sense of control. And even a perception of natural disasters for some people can cause them to lose that sense of control, which can lead to depression. So a car accident or a tree falling on your house or an accident where someone is injured, just that feeling of not being in control, that you have no control over what is happening around you, can lead to depression. A footnote to that is after pregnancy, many women become depressed. It's called postpartum blues. And what is happening with those is a hormonal change. And oftentimes that's not perceived. And the hormone change that happens can cause a very severe depression, especially if a woman is not nursing, because during nursing the same kinds of hormones are still present, and so that gradual depletion of the hormones that build up during pregnancy isn't as dramatic, and a depression will not happen. And it's been a fallacy, I think, for many years that during menopause a woman will become depressed because of the hormone loss, but it's just not true. A woman that is depressed during menopause is depressed because of other reasons, not because of the menopause. And it's been really easy to just lay a blanket thing on that and say, well, they're menopausal, of course they're depressed, and not really treat the causes of that. So I kind of wanted to put a footnote into that the loss of what can be perceived as your childbearing functions and that sort of thing is not necessarily caused by that hormonal change during menopause. And after pregnancy, like if a woman nurses, those hormonal changes can be lessened through nursing. But that's, anyway, just kind of a footnote to that, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about that.
Can I ask about menopause? Is there more, since there's hormonal changes going on during menopause, could that set out depression? If there's depression already there, is that a good time for it to blossom, I guess is what I'm trying to say?
If the depression already is there, the depression is there not because of the hormonal changes, because they're gradual at that
right.
time. They take a period of years. And just like I said, during pregnancy, a woman experiences her hormones become a lot more hormones of that kind during the pregnancy that kind of keep her mood stable. During pregnancy, these hormones build up in the body that help her to remain calm. They're kind of an antidepressant, and she remains calm, and she's a good nurturing place for that infant to be growing. These drop off dramatically at birth, and that's when a postpartum depression can occur. But that isn't what happens during menopause. There's no dramatic drop off of hormones that have built up over a period of time. So, but I don't know that that's always understood. And
is it understood, or have you looked into the monthly cycle as far as chemical effects on that as opposed to psychological? Is that
a little bit, and yes, it can. I think, you know, there's, and for certain women that might be a factor. But I think it's something that could be registered and monitored, and it wouldn't lead to a long term. When I'm talking about depression now, I'm not talking about just those little moods that we go through weekly or monthly, but a mood plunge that goes down and stays down for months, for a very long period of time, and that has nothing to do with fluctuations that we all experience daily, weekly, monthly.
Speaking about menopause, you only think about women.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said,
don't you think this kind of menopause for men too?
Like I said, I don't know that much about it, and I'm not a psychiatrist, and I don't know. I just think that there's a fallacy when it comes, or I've been led to believe that there's a fallacy when it comes to blaming women's depressions at a later age on menopause, because generally the causes are something else. And it's just real easy to point to that and say, that woman is depressed because she's going through menopause, just kind of pat her on the head and give her some hormones and everything's going to be better, and that isn't the case. There's usually some real deep reasons for the depression. And some of those would have to do with the gradual change. Okay, I've talked about major life changes. Now the gradual changes that can happen in anybody's life, just in the process of going through your different life stages. And inability to cope with your life stages as you're going through them can cause depression. So for an adolescent who is searching for self-actualization to remove him or herself from parents, to become an individual person, if they are not able to cope with those changes, and that kind of gradual loss of family can become depressed. Did you have something, Greg? Oh. In the 20s, if a person is not able to cope with finding life goals, finding a job, deciding what they're going to be doing with their lives, they can become depressed if they cannot seem to make sense out of where they're going and what they want to be. For a person in their midlife, what we call a midlife crisis, again, there's changes happening. Either children are growing or a job needs to change, or you get to the point where, okay, I had all these plans for my life and now I'm in my 30s and none of these came about and I've been cheated. Depression can happen then if there's a sense of, I've been cheated, I haven't been fulfilled, I'm not where I want to be at this time in my life. Later on, I think for women and for men both, when the children leave, or when a divorce happens, or when those kinds of changes that happen often later in life, not being able to cope with those and find new directions and new goals. And then for women and men, geriatric kinds of depression, that my life is over, it's lived, I can't go back and I can't do it over again, and somehow it doesn't make sense. Somehow I don't have, or I didn't do, or I look back and it's been wasted. And real severe depressions can happen then. And that's where I think it's real easy to focus on things like menopause instead of focusing on a person that's not fulfilled, that looks back and grieves for a lost life and can't live it over again. And you know, dealing with that, coping with that, accepting the change. Okay. We talked about, you know, major changes and then gradual changes. Now some... just a little bit about outward stress that we have all heard so much about. But outward stress can cause depression, that feeling that you're in a squirrel cage and you can't get out of it. Or the feeling that you're just caught in the mire of some swamp somewhere and you keep clawing and clawing and you can't seem to get out. And this can be caused by your financial situation, if you just can't seem to get out of poverty. Or it can be caused by real success, where you're caught in that success trap and can't get out of that either. Find that you're overworked and going every which way. Don't have time for me. Don't have time to work on the interpersonal relationships that are so vital. And what happens is a death of hope then in your lifestyle. Either a hope that you'll ever get out of this swamp that you're in, or a hope that you can get out of that fast paced. And when there's death of hope, then depression can happen. And the inward stress can happen from the angers and the fears that are turned inward, that are repressed. And repression is a big, repression of emotions is a big cause of depression.
Repression?
Yeah, repression. Taking your angers, your fears, and stuffing them, not looking at them, not dealing with them. And those can be angers and fears that can come from childhood. And a lot of people really need work with psychiatrists to work through things from the childhood that have been repressed, that haven't been dealt with. Also, it can be things that you're repressing about your daily life right now. Interpersonal relationships that are just not working, that are not satisfying. A marriage that just, for some reason, isn't working to give you the love, the nurturance, the feeling of self-esteem that you need in order to not be depressed. It could be unrelieved loneliness. Loneliness can be a real trigger for depression. There's a word called anomie, which is social isolation. And this often happens to people when they have moved and they find themselves in a new situation and they're isolated. They don't have close friends. They're lonely. For women in the United States especially, loneliness is a big problem, because often a woman that is home with small children, or a woman that is put into a certain social type of situation, can be very, very lonely. And it's not, sometimes it's simply not recognized for being what it is. That sense of aloneness, that sense of isolation of being alone. Another thing that is an inward stress is what is called the emotional bank depletion. And I'd like to read a quote out of Unfinished Business about this. There is a particular explanation of what causes depression, which has it that depressive episodes are a response to an insufficiency in the giving-getting or input-output outflow balance of a person's life. In other words, if one can imagine a human being as a kind of an emotional bank into which love supplies are being deposited and from which they're being withdrawn, then the depressed person is either someone who has suffered a staggering loss in the recent past, or someone who on a chronic level finds herself or himself giving out far more than is being taken in terms of love, caring, nurturance, support. So being in a situation where your emotional bank is not being taken care of, where you're giving more out of that than you are getting in, can lead to very severe depression. An extreme of that is what is called the love addict. And for whatever reasons, the self-esteem in a person like this is so low that no matter how much love and nurturance is coming in, it's never enough to satisfy that person. But again, you have to look beyond that to what has caused that, you know, terrible and unsatisfiable inner emptiness. What is there within that person that just so hungry for love and nurturance? And that could very well be something from childhood where they cannot be fulfilled. Okay, four causes for depression, or four that I've kind of gleaned and put together. The treatments are many, and I think the more I've thought about it, people really need a combination of treatment when it comes to depression. There can be, of course, for chemical depression, the antidepressants, the lithium, and those chemical kinds of things to restore the balance within the body. Psychiatric help, counseling, to go back to the roots of what is causing this, to be able to understand oneself, to be able to get out those repressed angers and fears. And in some cases, shock treatment is very valuable. And shock treatment has really bad press, but then we have images of the basement in some hospital, and you know, it's all kind of dim and awful in this electrical apparatus or whatever. Apparently now the treatment is very sophisticated and very safe, and in some cases a very severe depression is almost the only thing, especially I was reading the Maggie Scarf's book with a geriatric type of depression. Depression is very dangerous. People can die. I mean, either people will recover or they will die, because you go so far down and depressed people commit suicide. And if they don't commit suicide violently, especially older people will just kind of gradually die. They will stop eating, they will stop functioning, and they will die. And so as a life-saving means, shock treatment apparently can reverse that inability to eat, inability to sleep, and cause some really physical good effects, so then the person can be dealt with. But first of all, I mean, if it's life-threatening, first of all, you have to deal with that. As an emergency treatment, shock treatment can be very good and cause a person to want to live again, and cause those things to happen within the body, the chemical things to start working that restore their appetite, that restore their ability to sleep.
What is actually happening in the body when you're in shock?
I'm not sure. Like I said, I don't know that much about it, and just from what I've read, there's a good chapter in Unfinished Business about that if anybody wants to look at it farther, but I don't know if I, you know, would have time to really go into that. When you look at the physical characteristics of depression, and maybe we could do that right now, the erratic sleep patterns, a person is getting too much or too little sleep, the apathy, lethargy, loss of appetite, definite weight loss, and sometimes there can be weight gain too, I think Sarah Bogson mentioned in her tape. Nausea, lowered sexual drive, changes in personal appearance, the physical ailments, a person that is depressed is tired, weak, dizzy, general body aches, heart palpitations, tightening in the chest, breathing problems, headaches, constipation, diarrhea, sweating, lump in the throat, trouble swallowing. I mean, they're sick, physically sick, and especially with older people that are not getting nourishment, it can be very dangerous. And I don't know Like I said, I don't know exactly how it works, but some of these treatments, like shock treatment, can cause older people or anyone that is severely depressed to regain their appetite and be able to sleep. And then what's causing that depression can be dealt with. But you need to take care of the physical symptoms. You need to lighten the depression enough so then the person is capable of going through some psychiatric kinds of treatment and some self-help kinds of things. So while you're treating the symptoms, then it's really important to find the cause of the depression. And to find the root of the depression, then you can heal it, hopefully permanently, or make it something that the person can recognize and be able to deal with. So there are changes that are going to be necessary for healing to happen, often environmental, emotional, and physical kinds of changes. But a person who is depressed cannot do that by themselves. Like an alcoholic, oftentimes someone else is going to have to step in and do those things initially for the person, because when you are depressed, you have no conception of where you're at or what you're about, and you have no ability to do any of those things for yourself. The things that need to be done are to work through losses. If there's a grief problem, a death or whatever, those losses have to be worked through. The grief has to be worked through. A person has to be enabled to see the positive aspects of the change that has happened, the positive aspects of the move, the positive aspects of the life kinds of changes that are going on, and have goals and have new hope for the future. Maybe expectations need to be reduced or changed, just to cope with, okay, this is where I'm at in my life, and it's not exactly what I wanted, but this is what I've got, and this is good, and this is where I can go from here. Finding some other options for your life. Reducing your stress, and that's going to require some decisions in terms of lifestyle and what you do with your body. Getting exercise, changing eating habits, stopping doing a lot of the things that you're doing that are causing stress. Enhancing self-esteem by just doing some exercises that can make you feel good about yourself. Having your fears, guilt, hatreds, and all of that exposed. Really dealing with the grungies that are under there that might be seething around and causing the problem. Learning to risk, to try some new things, to change, to grow. And changing lifestyles, patterns, habits, and so on. And obviously a depressed person could do none of the above very well, if at all. Not when they're severely depressed. So I think it's really vital that others are educated and can step in and know what to do. In this book called The Answer to Depression by Norman Wright, there's a section on helping the depressed person, and I have this book if anyone wants to go through it. What should I do when a family member is depressed or a friend? What should I say? What shouldn't I say? And in here there are 11 things to do and ways to do them. As in understanding the causes and symptoms of depression, being educated about depression, watching out for the suicide, being very aware of the danger of depression and taking that very seriously, getting the depressed person to a doctor, even a general practitioner to begin with, who can give you some guidelines and some help, but treating it immediately, being supportive. Do not avoid the depressed person.
From your experience or readings, would the depressed person willingly often accept help if one, for instance, take to the doctor? Are they going to really fight against that?
They would probably fight against it, or they could. And so it does explain in here for each of these categories just how you go about doing that and things you can say, like with eating. It says empathize rather than sympathize. Sympathy can only reinforce a person's feelings of hopelessness, may make them feel more helpless, may lower already low sense of self-esteem.
What's the difference between sympathize and empathize then?
I think feel where they're at. Know what they're feeling and understand that, but don't say, I'm so sorry for you and isn't it too bad that you're depressed, but it's more, okay, I know you're feeling really crummy, what can we do about this? And being very active in doing that. And when I talk about my depressions, I'll mention some of the things that have been done for me in the past.
I would say, I think I had a real depressed point when I was a freshman in college, and my mother, who had been suffering with me through it off and on, just said,
you're going to get some help. And I was so glad she did that, because I could not, I would not do it for myself.
But you would accept it when somebody else took charge.
And well, said, and I don't know, it, of course, it depended on who it was, but of course, not, we were very close, and she just basically took my hand and said, it's time to do something, you know, and I've been very appreciative that she did that. But that's a good question.
What is it called when you do that for an alcoholic? What is that called?
Intervention.
Yeah, intervention. You need someone to intervene in the situation. Some of the things it says in here, if the person doesn't want to eat, you can say, look, you may not feel like eating, but you're probably hungry and starving won't help, so let's sit down and have this meal and try to prepare it attractively. If they're having trouble sleeping, get them into a warm bath before they go to bed. Play some quiet music, read. Things that you can do to assist the physical symptoms and then also deal with the emotional systems. If they are not doing anything, remind them of past enjoyment that have been derived from certain activities and just insist that they do those activities with you. Okay, we're going to go play miniature golf. That's something you liked to do before, and we're going to go do it now. And some of those kinds of things that people did for me really did help and kind of got me going again. If they're letting their appearance go, it says openly, clearly, and explicitly tell the person that they will enjoy fixing themselves up and that they'll feel better for it. Clean the house, open the windows, bring in fresh air, get them off the couch, because that's where I spent a lot of time, was just kind of on the couch. So once, you know, the depression has been intervened in and the person is on their way to recovery, I think it's really important to have education happening. I think it's really important to have education happening all the way through. Because then, once you've been educated about depression and the person can recognize the symptoms within themselves, it's like when you're taking Lamaze classes in childbirth. The important thing about a contraction is that you get on top of it, that you're aware of it before it happens and you can start your breathing exercises and then you can control that contraction in childbirth. Well, I think it's the same way with depression. If you recognize what's happening before it happens, you can get on top of it. You can start doing the things necessary to ward it off. And the third time I was depressed, I didn't realize it until it was way too late. I was driving home from church, and it was a beautiful spring day. It was like this. I mean, it was wonderful out. And I said, my God, I'm depressed. It was just gray, awful. And I didn't know it until that minute. And it was already well into it, and it was almost too late to do anything about it, except that I had learned enough in the past that even there, and with Bob's help, I was able to struggle out of that. Are there any other questions about that? And then I'll go into some personal experiences.
One of the causes of depression, that you didn't bring out, I might have missed it, was the hereditary characteristics. I worked at a psychiatric unit for a year and a half, and had a lot of depressed people in that. Roughly 85% women, at least 50% of those women had family history of a primary female depression. Even though those four categories might not even be affecting these people, just like within congenital heart disease and so on, there's a hereditary factor that plays with depressed people.
One thing that comes to mind is, would it be physical or hormonal or hereditary to like that, or is it a way that those women were taught to cope with things, the patterns they have? I mean, that's a factor in mind.
I think that with bipolar, manic depressive, it's a hereditary factor that's hormonal, but I agree. I think that with a lot of hereditary things, it's an environmental depression. But then again, why is it only women? Why primarily women are depressed?
I agree with you. One of the reasons I didn't say that, a lot of that is because of bipolar disorder, definitely is hereditary. And then I really agree with what Jane is saying, that, well, for one thing, we really don't know how all of this ties together. I think that there's something chemical going on with anybody that gets depressed, and there's something hereditary, there's lifestyle, just the way you've been raised, that it's passed on from generation to generation. It's a really excellent article or chapter in this book. If you don't read any of the rest of the book, I would suggest that everybody reads chapter 13 in this. And it's, let's see, what's the name of it again? It's Femininity as Symptom, I think. And it really talks about women and depression and just the way we've been raised as women, the expectations that have been placed upon us. It's an excellent chapter, and it really kind of makes one angry, too.
I can see, too, where what you're talking about is kind of passed on from in families. I've known families where even the language they deal with it so much. And they talk about all the time being depressed, feeling depressed, and others where that just isn't even part of the language. And I think it can work both ways, because physically, for whatever reason, some people don't seem as susceptible. But also that it can just be a way of thinking and dealing, too, where you get into that response more readily.
Well, the coping skills that I have learned from my mother, she learned from her mother and her mother before her, I would imagine. And so when stress or life situations hit me, I cope in that way. Go ahead, Greg.
I think the environmental question Jane brought up is really important, because by and large, most depressed people are women, the majority are women. But the same women are depressed raising men and women. But the women become the depressed individual. And you know, either that's a environmental factor, or because the woman will pass on hereditary characteristics to all the children. So
of course,
I don't think there's any real positive answer on it. It's just a question that's continually brought to the forefront, because the majority of people that are getting depressed in our society are women.
Or it's more obvious, too.
I was going to say, is it acceptable for a man to be depressed in our society?
I don't know. If you're depressed, I don't think...
I'm supposed to be thinking about the depression. That's another question of acceptable or not.
You just haven't.
And
but
do you believe
you
it
talk
in
about
that?
It's that people would talk about being depressed about if a man was in the same way that you say, oh, she's...
I think you're so debilitated that you can't function in some respects.
Is it the fact that the majority of depressed people in our
states
are women?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
I think in Holland it's the opposite, yes.
That's why I wondered if it's a bit about how we talk about it, or we just don't talk about it when it's men that are as much as men.
And I myself, I can speak from experience.
Yeah.
I'm about the same as you. I have had 3 times a very serious depression in my life, and the last one was the worst. And again, I think it in Holland it happens more to men than to women.
Two of my colleagues were men, and one of them also a teacher has been away from school 2.5 years. And his father has a family, but it was very, very serious. He was also treated in a psychiatric hospital.
You know, men. I think men become depressed if they get into chronic depression, where they can't do anything, can't work, and so on. But it's factual also that the highest rate of successful suicides are men.
It was interesting, because women oftentimes will take medication, will do something that's not quite as drastic as putting a gun to their head. I mean, men seem to choose ways of committing suicide that are pretty final. Women will often take pills and can be found before they're actually...
One thing they say about men who are depressed, usually become alcoholics. Or they drink their problems, and although they're not, I don't know if they're alcoholics or not, but the problems come out through alcoholism in this country. So a lot of people, a lot of men who are being treated for alcoholism cause depression and symptoms of alcohol abuse. And I think that's a disguise for a lot of depression for men in this country. They say that men also very few successful men in this country get depressed. But the ones with the best jobs are constantly being reinforced with how productive and how useful they are.
So I have to use alcohol as a medicine.
Yeah. Well, that's...
It can only help to neglect it.
Right.
Not to care it.
Right. But that's how a lot of men aren't diagnosed as being depressed. They are diagnosed as being alcoholic or alcoholic abusers.
But as a footnote to that, John, I think what Karen is talking about is people who become depressed to the point where they're not able to work. They're not able to function. They're not able to receive positive strokes from their work because they just aren't able to take anything positive in. They just want to stay at home. They don't want to go to work. They don't want to go to the bar and drink. I think there's a difference between feeling high and low than being chronically depressed for, you know, 4 to 6 to 2.5 years.
Depression and alcoholism go hand in hand. Most, many, many depressed people self-medicate with alcohol, which is kind of ironic because it's actually a depressant. And just, I think it can be. I think your, when you really start healing is when you are able again to make that choice and to say, I will not be depressed anymore. I will do these things to care for myself. And I will ask these things of the people around me to care for me so that, but that only can happen either before you get so low that you can't do anything about it or when you've come off the bottom far enough that you can take some decisions, make some decisions for yourself. And that's why I think education is so important about depression because, like I said, you can't, once you're in the pits and you haven't realized it until you're there, you're stuck. It's, you can't make any decisions anymore. So it's either before you get there or after you've been rescued from, and then can recognize what's going on and be able to take those kinds of steps next time. For me, the first time I was depressed was when I was age 16. Are we kind of done with this? Shall I go on a little bit?
Sure.
Okay. I was age 16 and I was a junior in high school, and of course I probably hadn't even heard of depression or knew what it was, and no one, those closest around me didn't label it as that. I was able to label it as that later when I was in college and learned about it. What was happening, I was crying all the time. I would just cry morning, noon, and night. I would cry all my way through school. I'd come home and cry. Finally, my parents took me to our general practitioner who gave me some sort of antidepressant. I'm not sure what it was because my family didn't talk about it, of course. The causes were never talked about. What was really going on was never talked about. I was just medicated. And I know that if I didn't take my little white pill in the morning, I did not get through the day at school because I just cried. And I had violent headaches. I was a little bit anorexic. I got down to about 85 pounds because I was not eating. Exhausted, of course. And just had no ability to cope or make decisions, like within school with my schoolwork. I can look back on it now and say I was depressed, but nobody ever said that at the time. They wouldn't talk about it. I have no idea, like I said. They took me to the doctor and little white pills. I have no idea. It could have been a placebo for all I know, except that I know that if I didn't take them, I was really did not get through the day.
Karen, what did they talk about? I mean, what did, if someone, you know, what's wrong with Karen? What did the family respond?
You didn't talk about it at that time. I just had headaches and it was kind of up in the air, and every now and then I was threatened with being taken to a psychiatrist, but that was a threat. If they really would have done it, it would have been wonderful. But I came from a pastor's family where, at that time, he was a German Lutheran pastor, and it was Herr Papa, and you did not talk about any problems within the family.
But they must have considered it somewhat psychological, or they were threatened that they will take you.
Well, they were terrified. Mm-hmm. They were very frightened, mm-hmm. And they coped with it as best they could, which was to shove it under the carpet and hope it would all go away, which it did, eventually. Well, I did. At that time, I was already dating Bob, my husband. And when I got to 85 pounds, Bob flatly told me that I was not attractive anymore and that I better put on some weight. And I mean, it was that kind of an intervention that said, about this one person that I cared about. And oftentimes, a person that is depressed, there will be one person between them and, you know, eventual suicide. There can be one person that can intervene and that can say. And it's that one person that they care the most about. And for me, that was Bob, who said to me, "You're getting too thin. Put on some weight." And I started eating. And I know the stress was relieved because the doctor recognized enough of the stress going on that I was like exempted from final exams that year. I didn't take any more tests during that year. I just kind of went to school and went to the classes, but I didn't take any exams. And that kind of stress was relieved. The things that caused it, looking back, a lot of it was stress. I was just too involved in too many things, piano, flute, schoolwork. I was desperately trying to get a scholarship for college, so I was keeping my grades at A pluses. There were the gradual changes of adolescence going on, low self-esteem. I didn't have a lot of friends except Bob, because everyone in that school was really much into sports, and I wasn't. I was into music, and I went to Portland for my piano lessons, and they just never understood me. I was into books and music, and I didn't like sports, and I was just different and not really accepted. I was liked, but not accepted to where I fit into the group. And of course, at adolescence, that's just a real big thing. And so that was a stress. And at the time, Elmer was talking this morning in Bible study, some real spiritual depression, some real spiritual struggles. And that was a lot of it. I just couldn't come to grips with God as God was being presented by my parents, by my family. I could not come to grips with this very judgmental God. I didn't feel saved, in quotes, and at that time that was really important. I dreamt about going to hell every night, and I was just terrified. And my father would come in and pray with me, and then I'd just be nauseous the next morning because it was so emotional, and I just couldn't handle that with him either, with my father. So a lot of the spiritual struggles were happening, and I think I just kind of, it was inner and outer stress at that point, and the changes of adolescence. The end of my junior year, and by the time summer happened, I went away and stayed with my sister, my older sister, on the farm for the summer. And I was getting up in the morning with my nieces and going out and working in the fields, and had a really good summer. And I think it lifted at that point, and I was able to face senior year in high school. My grades were good. I did get my scholarship, and all of that kind of lifted during the summer, and I'm not real sure why. I think it was the doctor's support. Just, I did go in and see him periodically, and we kind of talked, so it was a sort of an informal counseling, at least having that support. Having Bob's support, there was a couple of teachers in school at that point that started giving me some real support and real strokes as far as my self-esteem and my worth. The second time I was age 18, I was a freshman in college, and a lot of that was the change again, leaving home. The symptoms at that time were an extreme nervousness, out of control. I was either sleeping a lot, I would just come home and just sleep constantly at the dorm, to an extreme nervousness in terms of hyperventilating, not being able to make decisions. Again, I think that it was an inward and outward kind of stress, the changes of going to college. Bob, my real important other, was in Vietnam, so there was a lot of fear. I didn't have a lot of support from my family about him being in Vietnam, because the family back home kind of felt, well, now I would go off to college and find a nice boy to get hooked up with. His family was not German Lutheran, and they definitely came from the wrong side of the tracks in terms of they spent most of their time in the tavern rather than in church. And so I kind of struggled with this very important relationship on my own without the family support. A roommate that I had moved into college with, who had been my best friend from the time I was a freshman, was not able to handle me anymore in terms of my changing in college. The religion classes I was taking, that spiritual struggle was ending because I was saying, wow, there's a new way of looking at God. And you know, I can handle the way I'm being taught the Bible, I can handle the way I'm being taught faith, and she couldn't. So there was a divorce from this best friend, childhood friend at that time, and she actually moved out of the room and another roommate moved in, and those kinds of changes. And each little thing is not so big, but you put all the little things together and you have a big lump of stress that if it's not coped with appropriately can cause depression. And at that point I realized what was happening, and I went over to the counseling and testing center and said help immediately. And I was on medication for a couple of weeks just to handle the physical heart palpitations and hyperventilating and all that sort of thing. But I went into counseling. So I did about 3 years of counseling while I was at college and worked through the childhood things with my parents, the things that were causing the real spiritual agonies, the self-esteem kinds of things, the who am I as a person kinds of things. And I got some really supportive professors. I was at PLU who just were wonderful in terms of loving me, caring for me, telling me I was worthwhile, telling me I was intelligent, telling me I was worth having around, and those kinds of things. Again, had a really wonderful summer. That was kind of one of the ironic things I found after each of my depressions lifted right at the beginning of summer, and I had really neat healing summers after each one. That summer after that depression, I was taking a lot of art classes, running around in shorts and painting and sculpting, and made some really good friends and dating a lot. Just kind of healing things. And again, it was coming from a feeling of being isolated, being different, being alone, to a sense of belonging, having friends, having support and care. And I just, for me, it's just, I think, real vital in the treatment of depression that there are people that love you and that care about you and that can support you and wherever you're at. The third time in the worst depression was when I was age 29. And again, a lot of stress, but also loss at this point. And it was unexpected, because somewhere between the second depression and the third depression, I had kind of had a reconversion experience. Okay, I'm born again now and everything's great. I've got it all together with God and I'll never be depressed again. And so it just hit me out of the blue, because all of a sudden I was. And in a way, it was kind of a rejection by God too. You know, wow, why is this happening? I thought I had it all together. I thought, God, you and I had it all together here. And now I'm depressed, and did I do something wrong? I mean, there's often so much guilt associated with being depressed. You blame yourself because you're feeling that way. You blame yourself because you're not feeling good about the world. And then when people come along and tell you, like they did to me periodically, was, these are the best years of your life, it just adds to that guilt. Or, you should feel better than this. Or, look at all the wonderful stuff around you, and here you're just at the pits and you can't see anything. And it adds a lot of guilt. So those are things, I think, in educating oneself about depression, it's really important to realize the things not to say as well as the things to say. The symptoms at that time were just really classic, just a total joylessness, an inability to function. Like I said, I spent a lot of time just on the couch, not able to make any decisions, not able to decide whether I'm going to get up and go cook something or eat something or go to the bathroom or what I'm going to do. I just, there. I don't remember, what's really sad to me is that year John was 3 years old, our John, and I don't remember him as a three-year-old. It's blank, and I find that really sad, the memory loss that happens with depression. I've lost a year of my son's life, and that's a real grief. The things that I think had brought this on, for one thing, we had moved from Oregon to Washington. Bob went through two job changes at the time, and the second job change required that he commute to Seattle. So from Olympia to Seattle, he was going through two rush hours and driving 5 or 6 hours a day. So I was also suffering from the isolation and the aloneness and the insecurity of, okay, now what do we do? We've bought this brand new house and he's driving to Seattle. Are we going to try to sell it and move again? During the course of the move, I'd had a miscarriage. So a lot of it was grief. The hormone changes, I'm sure, happened. A lot of little things. He totaled one of our cars going to work early. Somebody ran into him. It was early enough in the morning. It was a no-fault kind of thing. We lost our insurance. We lost the car. Because we did not have any medical insurance, I was having to do daycare to pay for the miscarriage, which was just very depressing in any case. just a lot of little things. And then again, on top of that, the spiritual struggle of, okay, I'm, you know, thought we had this all together, God, and now I'm angry, and I'm not enjoying life, and I'm scared, and what's going to happen, and I'm not trusting. So those kinds of spiritual struggles as well. However, I was well enough on top of it, even though it really hit me out of the blue, and I realized I was at the bottom when I was already at the bottom. Because Bob had already gone through it before, he was able to do some very positive things for me. Like one in particular, I remember he simply got me off the couch, took me down, out, got me in the car, we went down to a shopping center and we window shopped. I mean, he just kind of dragged me around the shopping center and kind of pointed me at stores and said, here is color and life and food and things to live about. Start living. And at the time, I didn't feel like I really wanted to, and I kind of dragged around, but I remember that now as being a very definite turning point for me, that intercession where he made me just go out and witness life and basically telling me that it was good. I became pregnant with Jenny, and the hormonal kinds of things, I think, you know, really helped those, that change and that positiveness. Really was positive for me, and I recovered. One of the things that I did, though, and one of the things I wanted to talk about was the Bible study I did at the time. The church that we were involved with, I don't know how it came up, but well, it was just, for me, I feel it was real godsend. Two women who had been severely depressed, one had been hospitalized with depression, the other had had periodic depressions for years, started a Bible study at church, and it was called On the Assurance of Hope in Jesus Christ. So the name of the Bible study was Hope, and I heard about this and I started going to it. And it was one of the most helpful things in terms of the education I received, the support, and finding that community again after moving and finding other people to be with. It had 10 sessions on such things as guilt and forgiveness, handling the shoulds and the oughts, overcoming anxiety and worry, self-acceptance and life goals, feelings and attitudes, communication and support, family relationships and the future. And each Bible study would take a section of the Bible, and it was worked as a regular Bible study where the questions, and you read the scripture verse and then you write the answer. And of course it was all directed toward finding assurance, finding God's nurturance, even when we weren't feeling the nurturance within ourselves or maybe even with those around us. And we were given hymns and psalms to recite, and if we were not capable of reciting them, they would do some calligraphy for us of scripture verses or of promises of hope, and we had them tacked up on our refrigerators and on the walls and all that sort of thing, all the people in the class. Of course, we had the networking of support, telephoning whenever we needed to call, we could call, and prayer. We would pray for each other. It was a Christian group, and we were very much in tune to where God was within this. And I've got a lot of papers from that class. I've got the Bible studies, and I do have the handouts that came from there. Like I've got a paper that's just on guilt, and there's 5 points on what guilt is. Handling the shoulds and oughts, practical application. Try to get at the root of your guilt. Ask yourself why. Why are you guilty? Is it legitimate guilt, or is it because of what others might think? And then being able to handle the kinds of shoulds and oughts you're getting from other people and from yourself, and understanding those. Fear and anxiety. Normal fear versus abnormal fear. And anxiety, what that is. And then suggestions in dealing with fear. So along with each Bible study, which directed itself at a specific topic, we had like a handout that was educational in terms of, okay, what is this thing and what do you do about it? Your self-image, anger, what does anger do, what causes anger, ways to deal with anger, and so on. And I found that really helpful. First and foremost, I wasn't alone anymore. I wasn't the only one depressed. There was a whole bunch of us. We were depressed together. And we tried not to talk about it as the depression class we were going to. We tried to talk about it as the hope class we were going to. And then it was the education, which I think is so important for ourselves and for our families. And the acceptance of, okay, this is what's happening to me now, and this is where I'm at, but there is hope, there is a future. Given tools to deal with all those little problems. What do I do about my guilt? What can I do about my anger? What can I do about my fears?